The LARB Radio Hour is a free weekly podcast of the Los Angeles Review of Books, a reader-supported nonprofit publication. To support our continued work on this show, in print and online, please consider donating or joining as a member today at lareviewofbooks.org/radiohour. Hello and welcome to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported LA Review of Books. I'm your host, Eric Newman, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Kate Wolf. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Eric.
On this week's show, I'm speaking with Tommy Orange about his new novel, Wandering Stars.
Oh, I really liked They're There.
Yeah, so then I think you will also like Wandering Stars, because it picks up pretty much... Well, it's both a prequel and a sequel to They're There. So it, in many ways, it will continue the action right after They're There, you know, with the shooting that closes that novel. Spoiler alert for some of our readers, maybe, but I encourage you to read both. But it also kind of rewinds all the way back to the 1800s and the Sand Creek Massacre. And so it gives kind of a prehistory of the family that we first encounter in They're There, and gives this new novel, Wandering Stars, a kind of multi-generational saga. And it is really beautiful, also very painful. It's a story about a lot of loss, a lot of addiction, and it's kind of cast over it is this kind of long history of how the United States has systematically tried to stamp out the culture and identity of indigenous and native peoples that were here before the United States.
I remember from there that I hadn't even known about this kind of sit-in that took place in San Francisco, the occupation of Alcatraz Island, which is this really important moment in Native American history that I had not known about before that book. So I think there's this way in which Tommy Orange is doing so many important things in his writing, both writing personal stories of a single family, and then probably for those who are not as much in the know, schooling us in like these larger moments of Native American history and putting them all together, I think is really exciting. And you know, I can see why people are celebrating him, because that is like one thing that novels can do so well.
Yeah, I think what you've said there about Tommy Orange kind of combining both histories that we're not used to hearing, frankly. And so there is a sense of like, you will also learn a lot from reading Wandering Stars, just as you did from there, but also a very gripping tale of a family that is, many of its members, especially its younger members, are struggling with what it means to be Native, and how there's a very interesting story in here of a kid who discovers that he has, through a DNA test, discovers that he has some Native ancestry, and trying to really wrestle with what that means for him, what it would mean to claim that identity. Can he claim that identity? And how does that reshape how he understands himself? It is a beautiful, beautiful book, and I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with Tommy Orange.
That's great. I'm excited to listen.
All right, let's get to it. I'm thrilled to be joined today by Tommy Orange. Tommy is the author of There, his first novel, which won the Penn Hemingway Award, the John Leonard Prize, the American Book Award, and was named one of the New York Times 10 Best Books of the Year for 2018. It was also, I should mention here, a bestseller, which is not necessarily something that often happens to award-winning novels. He joins us today from Minnesota while on book tour to talk about his latest novel, Wandering Stars, which is a sort of prequel and sequel to There that starts with the ancestors of the characters from that first novel as they survive the Sand Creek Massacre and the ethnocidal program of so-called Indian schools, which attempted to stamp out Native language and culture in younger generations of indigenous folks who were stolen from their families and forced to convert to Christianity. The novel then flashes forward to explore the lives of Orville Redfeather, his brothers Luther and Lonnie, his great-aunt Opal, and his grandmother Jackie. We arrive in these characters' lives in the aftermath of the powwow shooting that nearly took Orville's life in the previous novel, following both him and his family members as they navigate both the immediate and epigenetic traumas that they suffer from, attempting to reconstruct a life and in many ways an identity in a country that continues to be hostile, if not totally indifferent, to them, their history, and their culture. By turns haunting, traumatic, and inspiring, Wandering Stars is a powerhouse of a novel that will stay with the reader long after they've turned its final pages. It's a pleasure to speak with you, Tommy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I want to talk a little bit about Wandering Stars as this kind of sequel and prequel to There, There. I know, obviously, There, There ends in a really dramatic way, so it does make sense why you would want to see what happens in the aftermath of that story. But I'm just curious kind of how you approach this novel as maybe a way of dealing with unresolved threads in the prior novel or seeing this novel is much more of an epic, right? It covers so much history. So just kind of wondering how you thought about the transition out of There, There and into Wandering Stars.
Well, at first, I was writing a pretty straightforward, like you said, there ends dramatically and also kind of a cliffhanger of sorts in terms of, you know, what happened to these people, especially key characters. So I was writing a very straightforward sequel in March of 2018. So before the book came out, I knew that I was writing the sequel and that it was going to be called Wandering Stars. Kind of came to me in a single moment, weirdly. Because the title with There, There, it was like 3 years into writing it before I landed on There, There as a title. And for whatever reason, this time around, I was like, it's going to be called Wandering Stars and it's going to be a sequel. And I started writing this before There, There came out. So I planned on doing something just very contemporary and following a lot of the threads in the aftermath just to see. I feel like there was a lot of layers to write into around, like, you know, a mass shooting event, but also it was this cultural exchange and it was interrupted by violence. And it just felt like there was a lot of layers to write into to what families, how families would feel coming away from that. But then I was in Sweden for the translation of There, There into Swedish. I was at a museum and I saw this newspaper clipping that talked about Southern Cheyennes being in Florida in 1875. And I knew that we were never in Florida for any reason that I knew about. So I ended up finding out that the origin of the boarding schools happened at this prison castle, which is in St. Augustine, which was actually the first colony, the European colony in the United States in St. Augustine. And so I find out that it's my tribe that's at the sort of, you know, was the blueprint or the seed for the school, and decide I'm going to do a lot of research and I want to try to find a way to tie this in somehow to this sequel thing. But I had no idea how. I had this title, though. I had Wandering Stars, and I find out that the prison castle is shaped like a star. And then I find out that one of the actual people who was there, his name was Star, and another was Bearshield. And Bearshield's one of the families from There, There. So I knew in that moment I would write a family lineage that would land us in the middle of the book, sort of where There, There leaves off. And then you would, as a reader, you would feel the historical weight and significance of what's going on in the present, even to some extent more so than the characters themselves, because they don't know some of the history that you involve yourself in.
Well, and that's a big focus. I mean, it was also in There, There, this kind of these questions of authenticity, and that's always bound up with this relationship to the past. But that's a very central part of the new novel, which is about, like, and I can understand then why you go back to this moment at Fort Marion, because that is the moment when that one of many moments, but a particularly intense one in which that relationship to the past is forcefully severed. I was interested in that moment. So in that first section of the book, you have Jude Starr's story of kind of surviving the Sand Creek Massacre as a child, being imprisoned at Fort Marion, which is run by Richard Henry Pratt. And this is all set up in the beginning for us in like a really great kind of historical preface. But then, you know, there were two quotes in particular that I wanted to ask you about. So the first is a Bible verse that, appropriately enough, I guess, comes from the book of Jude, that Jude learns and says resonates with him even before he gets to Florida, I think. And it gives the book its title. And that quote is, "Raging waves of sea foaming out their own shame, wandering stars to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever." Can you talk a little bit about how that reflects or kind of shapes the narrative of the characters in this multi-generational novel?
I actually I only knew it as a Portishead lyric first, and then found out.
I that love it was, that.
And it was actually, it was an opportunity for me. I was raised, I won't go too far off on a tangent about this, but I was raised evangelical Christian, and my dad was Native American church, but they both prayed to Jesus, and it's a whole confusing thing for a young person. But I had all this stuff that I wanted to write about, this Christianity sort of baggage, and finding out that Wandering Star, the lyric of the Portishead song that had biblical origins, gave me an opportunity to kind of think about using Christianity and the Bible, and having Jude Star think through like what would it have been like for him to experience Christianity and the Bible, especially if there were things that sort of matched an old Cheyenne story about a virgin birth, and just thinking about Christianity from this outsider perspective. And then this passage and the wandering itself, I think part of why the title stuck initially, and it was after hearing the Portishead song come on that I thought of it. I think this idea of wandering when you don't have a home anymore, it just felt like the verb itself was speaking to this sort of diaspora, or like, you know, we became in a lot of ways immigrants in our own country, the way that we were moved around and sort of sorted out. So it just felt like there was a lot happening in that Bible verse that expressed a lot of the characters. You know, shame comes from basically being taught that the Indian blanket ways are like subhuman, and the only way to be considered an actual person is to be civilized and Christianized. And so there's a shame that I think's in these characters around being a Native person, because at that time it was like, it's totally different now, but you have to understand it was seen as doing subhuman things. Like, we were dehumanized in so many different ways, and this process of assimilation was, it sounds like kind of a softer word, but at the time, like, the to do this to prisoners of war and then decide, let's do this with the children as an effective way to, you know, solve the Indian problem is pretty severe.
Yeah, I mean, and as you point out, both in the historical kind of preface, but also in Jude and then later his son Charles's story, you get at the brutality, you know, assimilation, you're right, it can sound very soft, but it's like these were very brutal tactics that not only involved the killing of indigenous people, but also when they were inside of these institutions, like the incredibly brutal force that was used to suppress any kind of expression of Native culture or any refusal to express or embrace the kind of quote unquote American culture, but usually Christianity or kind of the supremacy of the US government. But there's a second quote that actually comes from when Charles is telling his story and he's reflecting on his father, and he says, quote, "Stories do more than comfort. They take you away and bring you back better made." And that line is later picked up towards the end of the novel by Opal, who, again, reflecting on this, like, how do we transmit a history that has been so violently suppressed, is kind of wondering, my great-grandfather survived the Sand Creek Massacre, so that would be Jude, and his son survived boarding schools, and his daughter, my mother, survived losing her mother and being raised by white people and still brought us up knowing who we were, who we are somehow. So why had I been sheltering the boys from their culture, something made so strong it survived more than it should have survived? It was more than survival. The culture sings, the culture dances, the culture keeps telling stories that bring you into them, take you away from your life, and bring you back better made. Can you talk a little bit about the importance? I mean, and I can't ignore here that Wandering Stars is also a story. So the importance of storytelling and what you see as its transformational or preservational power.
I think art and entertainment and all, you know, there are functions that it served to. There is a comforting function that it can serve. Like, people sometimes just want to watch, you know, whatever's on when in the hotel room when you turn on the TV. There's that kind of thing. And art can also function as a tool for transformation and to reveal things, especially about this country that we should know about as Americans. And I think to do it artfully and to do it beautifully is the goal. And that sort of what it convinces the reader to be transported, and, you know, to have this information that you're trying to relay that is important, like this history of boarding schools as part of the way we think about Native history and Native people in the present. Has we're missing this whole middle section. We have like the Indian pilgrim story and then nothing. And then like all this qualification about who's the real Native person, like the burden is sort of on us. And so trying to convince the reader to be taken away and be given this information that is kind of brutal and harsh at times and sad, but ultimately going on this journey and moving through this story, the hope is that you're changed by the information. And I think, you know, the actual line just dropped in as I was writing. It came out pretty fast and pretty early in writing Wandering Stars. I don't know where it came from, but I think there's an urgency to some of these stories that have been missing from the larger narrative for too long that has to do with this idea of trying to rebuild and bring the reader back better for having gone to this place and to be transported into this darker part of American history that we really, it's not doing any Americans any good to not be thinking of these things or to have willful ignorance about the Native experience. Like, it's a huge part of how this country was founded on, you know, a lot of these darker aspects of the way we've treated Native people. So he was talking about hearing stories from his father and the idea that Native people had to learn how to disappear to survive. And I think the function of story, when you need to be transformed or when you need to get lost in story and be changed by it, I think there's a function of storytelling in Native communities that serves to try to rebuild you and is not just like, listen to this so you can go to sleep or be comforted by some nice fairy tale setting or something like that.
You know, as we've been talking about, kind of much of the novel describes this frustrated but yet enduring attempt to pass on cultural knowledge and inheritance to future generations. And one thing that struck me as maybe something of a benefit to the digital age is that this kind of knowledge is being preserved and made available online to wide swaths of Indigenous young people through things like YouTube, for example, but also other platforms and just the internet itself. You know, and I was contrasting that with Opal Viola's observation that at one point, it's early in the novel, she says, you know, that her mother, basically, as she is dying, kind of is telling her all of these Cheyenne stories, and that basically everything Opal knows about being Cheyenne or Cheyenne history is what she learns in this incredibly fraught and very tenuous moment of connection. So I'm kind of curious if you think the ability or what you think about the ability to kind of preserve and broadly disseminate tribal knowledge in via the internet kind of anticipates a renaissance of Indigenous culture, or does the internet pose other challenges to the kind of preservation or distribution of that knowledge?
I think this is kind of a tribe by tribe thing, because there's certain information that's like, if the tribe is good at taking care of tribal knowledge, cultural knowledge, and they also have like a savvy tech team, then you'll have a nice website with legitimate information. But you also have all these hokey sites when you just the front page, the early results of Google, if you're looking up Native stuff, there's a lot of like really cheesy, you can just tell by the background art that's happening. It's yeah. Just kind of like, this is like pan-Indian. This is pulling from no specific tribal knowledge. And some of it's legit, but it really just depends. And then other tribes have no presence, and you won't be able to find anything about certain. So, there's 574 federally recognized tribes and almost 400 non-federally recognized tribes. And so I think that the internet can be a tool, just like, you know, the internet can be a lot of things for a lot of different people. It can be a tool for dissemination, preservation. But I think, you know, it just depends on the organization of the tribe and the people, the access to knowledge. And a lot of times, assimilation, while also being kind of a softer word, it's also a more lasting effect. Like, my dad pretty much raised us to be assimilated. Like, it was strong. And, you know, I have a close friend that he's Mexican and was raised by two Mexican parents, but they raised him in a more assimilated way. There are ways that the lasting effects of assimilation don't end when the boarding schools end, or when, you know, after the civil rights moment, or as we get more progressive around our ideas of Native history and who Native people are. I think, you know, even growing up in the 90s, my dad's decision to like have you look like or be like more like other Americans as the like safer or more sure way to raise us. I think that can't be downplayed either, that assimilation was still in effect in my, you know, as I grew up. That is a tangent because I was thinking about the preservation of cultural ways and stories. And my dad also, in addition to further complicate things, carries a lot of wounds from the way he was raised. And so sometimes the passing on of cultural knowledge is a burden to share because it's tied to a lot of pain. There's so many complications around like how this information and knowledge gets passed on or does not. And it's often frayed. In my own life, it was a fraught thing. And my dad became much more vocal about it when we got older, but raising us, there was a lot that was not taught, just like Opal. I mean, I think the creation of a character who's protecting the boys, thinks she's protecting the boys from something. I think there was that going on in my house as well.
I want to shift for just a quick minute to talk about the character of Sean Price, you know, before we get into Orville and his brothers. So Sean is a character that when we meet him in the novel, he's learned through, I can't remember if it is 23andMe, but I think it's a genetic test basically that he's taken that has told him that he is 12.25% Native American, you know, so it doesn't specify anything. And for Sean's father, this is a kind of boon for Sean's college admission prospects. And that's like this very cynical perspective that kind of in transactional one, that being able to claim some kind of marginalized identity will give his son a benefit in college applications. But Sean, I think, both sees that for the cynical take that it is, but he's also really struggling himself to understand what it even means that he is, quote unquote, part Native American, and to what extent he can even lay any private, to say nothing of public, claim to that identity. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that character, kind of like if he's representative of a broader experience of those who may know that they have Indigenous ancestry, but otherwise have no access to what that means for them or their experience or their relationship to Indigenous people and culture.
Yeah, so I wanted to have Sean sort of be, he sort of stands in as a representative of Oakland in a way that Oakland has, it's a big mix of people. It's very diverse. You know, it's like a lot of biracial, a lot of mixed race families. And he's also adopted and raised by white people. And he even does this project where he's like being raised by white people as a person of color is, you know, it's akin or it's analogous to like a bigger thing that's happening to everybody because the white gaze and the American white sort of male dominance, it's equivalent to the way he's raised. It's like a macrocosm, microcosm thing. But this piece of knowledge about having DNA, it was just fascinating to me to also have him wonder about what it means to have that little bit. And yeah, and the different take between somebody who's sensitive to what a person of color may experience and what it means to carry the weight of that history, his reaction versus his dad's. So it's just, like you said, it's transactional. How can we profit from this? So I wanted him to be sort of trying to move toward some kind of claim or reclamation of Native ancestry, while Orville was also sort of moving away from it because he was traumatized by this experience. And I wanted those two things to sort of cross and meet each other at a moment in time.
You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour. I've been speaking with Tommy Orange, author of Wandering Stars. We'll return to that conversation in just a moment, but first we have this week's book recommendation.
I have the sociologist Gretchen Sisson on the line. Her new book is called Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. And she's here to give me a book recommendation.
So one of the books that really fed directly into my work was the book, The Turnaway Study, which was written by my colleague and mentor, Diana Green Foster. And some of the data in my book comes directly from the Turnaway Study. But what Diana and I, and mostly our colleagues, worked on was looking at what happens when women are denied access to abortion. What do their lives look like for the next 5 years? What do their relationships look like? What is the impact on their children, their families, their finances, their health, their overall well-being? And I think it's just a really brilliant case of what happens when people are denied access to abortion care.
And was there like an overarching narrative of what that is?
Yes. So, you know, I think as Diana documents in the book, just the number of ways that women are really require access to abortion to have control over their lives. And the reasons that women give for wanting access to abortion are reflected in the impact that denial of abortion has on their lives. So women will often say, I need to have an abortion because I already have children. I need to care for the children that I have, and I won't be able to do that if I have one more child. And we saw that reflected in how they were able to care for their children. They'll often say, I can't afford to have another kid. We saw that in the impact that this had on their credit scores and their finances over time. I need to have an abortion because I don't want to have an abortion with this partner, right? We saw that women who were denied abortion care were more likely to stay in unsafe relationships longer. And so I think that the stories that she shares in the book are a really good reflection of why we just need to trust people on the reasons that they need to have access to abortion in their lives.
Hear, hear. Will you tell me the title of the book?
The full title of the book is The Turnaway Study, 10 Years, 1,000 Women, and the Consequences of Having or Being Denied an Abortion.
And the author?
Diana Greene Foster.
Thank you so much, Gretchen.
Yes.
That was Gretchen Sisson. Her new book is called Relinquished.
You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour. We now return to our conversation with Tommy Orange, author of Wandering Stars. Yeah, and that's like, because, you know, Orville and Sean... Well, Sean kind of gravitates to Orville because he knows that Orville is Indian, but doesn't, and he's hoping that Orville can help him unpack this, like, what this means. But then Orville kind of tells Sean, and the quote is, no Indians, so Sean is asking Orville if it's okay for him to use the term Indian, right? Or if he should use Native American or any other number of terms. And Orville tells him, you know, quote, no Indians from when they first named us Indians would recognize us as Indians now. That's not even what they would have called themselves. They all had their own languages and names for everything. So I wonder, in some sense, is Orville being particularly pessimistic or kind of having his own, and we'll talk about this in a minute, but his own trauma reaction to kind of reject this identity, that it's like, well, I mean, yes, but they wouldn't even, this referent that we have wouldn't even recognize us as related to them. And it did make me wonder kind of about this fraught relationship that maybe contemporary Indigenous communities have to their historical antecedents. In other words, is this just Orville being Orville and going through his own thing, or is this representative of like a larger problem that is the result of these centuries of oppression and forced assimilation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's mostly Orville having resentment for the way that his curiosity in the culture led to him being shot while he was dancing, and sort of the trauma of that. That's most of what's going on. I think that in urban areas, there's a lot of, so I've worked with a bunch of Native youth, and there's a lot of mixtures of tribes or races. And there's also like a keen knowledge of what tribe people are, and a lot of attempts at acquiring at least some amount of language. I see in these newer generations more pride and less of the remnants of assimilation piece. I see reclamation and of language and identifying being something that is valued much more than in my lifetime, where it was like a curiosity. I think there's a lot of outside qualification that makes people kind of double down. If they know that they can claim it, they double down on like, yes, I am real. I don't need to be qualified by people who don't think that my version of being Native is not enough. So I see a little bit more like people leaning into it and not in the spirit of Orville, who's just very pessimistic. But it's really him just being fresh from having this trauma happen and feeling like his life changed for the worse, and blaming in a way, blaming the culture or his curiosity about the culture. And, you know, he cuts his hair in this moment where Lonnie's outside and Lonnie comes inside and doesn't know if he caused a little earthquake that he felt or if, or, you know. So there's this idea of severance and wanting to cut himself off. And he has a conversation with his therapist and he's very much like, all that stuff is corny, or like, we're trying at something that's not really, for something that's not really there. So I think it's also, you know, somebody who does deeply want to belong and connect, but has taken on this like level of doubt at like, what is the real thing that I'm going to connect to? Not this other stuff that was part of how I got shot. Like, what does it really mean? And so it's almost like a deepening of his, an attempt at a deepening of his knowledge at how he's actually connected to his native identity.
But then it feels a lot of times for Orville that it's like, he is so caught in the trauma of what happened to him in the shooting, but also these kind of longer histories of trauma that have besieged his kind of family line as it exists in the novel, that he seems to kind of, like you're saying, with his therapist, he's, everything is corny. And some of that is also, we have to remember, he's a teen, right? You know, so he's also like kind of a young person that is working out what his own agency looks like and trying to work all of that stuff out coming out of extreme trauma. But it seems like he kind of also feels that this is a pain he will never be rid of. And that I wonder if in part that's what kind of pushes him towards addiction. There's a motif that recurs throughout several characters from the past, and definitely Orville, of a bullet that is lodged in the body. And I wondered if that was perhaps like a symbol of this trauma that's just always there and always threatening to destroy you. Because you have this beautiful line about they can't take the bullet out because that potentially, so they can't remove the source of the trauma because that would potentially cause other complications. But that it's also, there's a lot of writing about the path that the bullet takes is what determines its impact on the body. I've prefaced this far too much, but if you can just talk a little bit about that kind of like the insuperability of trauma and the kind of way that that seems to route many of the characters in this book towards addiction.
You know, I think the bullet being kept in the body is also kind of like, it's this, it feels like an artifact from the past. And there's a lot of talk about the wound being a kind of portal that's, it's letting stuff in from the past, or is trying to fill some hole that needs to be filled. And that's that pain and this idea that it's not going to go away. And also he knows, you know, that his mom was an addict, and he sort of feels like he comes from this addict blood. So I do feel like there's a weight and a hopelessness around carrying the trauma or feeling this wound that definitely is part of the addiction piece. But it's also, and this is what I wanted to write into addiction in a way that made it, kept it as human and complex as I could. So like Orville, when he starts to get into doing the drugs, he also feels like he's feeling stuff that he hadn't allowed himself to feel in ways that's not usually, there's a lot of talk about drugs being, you know, just a numbing agent to stop the pain. And that's certainly true for a lot of people. But with Orville, he also feels like it's giving him permission to feel things because he feels safe with the feeling that the drugs, you know, supplant him with. So while, yes, there's a hopelessness and a wound that ties across these generations, these people to their addictions, but there's also this other draw that Orville finds, even meditations on art and why a lot of artists have relationships to substances and even are riddled with substance abuse. This is like an artist story that he's connected to. It's like, there's got to be a reason why all these people do drugs and make art. And he's sort of like, so there's all these different factors that I have Orville thinking about and that contribute to his addiction and his inability to kind of come out of it.
The moment when Sean and Orville connect is also like overshadowed by this. You can see it coming from a mile away, right? That, so the other thing for readers is that Sean's father makes drugs called blanks, which are basically opioids, I think. So Sean and Orville are becoming friends. They realize they've been talking online for a long time. So they have this kind of pre-existing relationship. And it's this moment of incredible tenderness. They share that they've both lost their mother. You know, so there's lots of this wonderful connection and kind of healing connection. And then we see almost immediately that what this is going to turn into is Sean providing Orville with drugs that are going to cause him to spiral. I mean, I just wonder what that was like. Because obviously, you're the writer, so you kind of, maybe you also, the process of writing, sometimes you don't know where things are going. But that was a moment where, as a reader, I was like, oh God, no, no. Like, this is such a, it's such a positive and very beautiful moment that is just so darkened by what you see coming down the road. So just what was it like to write that relationship, but also kind of know where it seemed to be inevitably going?
Yeah, I, you know, and it felt almost like, can I do this to Orville after, you know, after what happens at the end of the first book?
Yeah.
And like the reader is just now getting this relief of like, he's alive. And immediately there's sort of this foreboding, like, oh, he's going to go down this path. But I think I was always going to have Orville react in this way. And addiction has sort of been a big part of my life through family members, and I've had personal struggles myself. And so having this really strong reason for Orville to end up having a relationship to drugs, it felt like I was able to, Orville was a kind of conduit for all of these generations to have an attempt to heal after, you know, after falling pretty hard, and Orville does, and you can see it coming, like you said, from a mile away. But it also gives him the opportunity to heal in ways that none of the people in his family line have. And so I needed to know that he was going to pull through and come out of it, even though he was going to go down this dark path of addiction. In writing it, I could write about how low he could go, because I always knew in writing it that he was going to come out of it. So there was never part of the process where I was like, I'm definitely going to go down this path with Orville. I don't know where it's going to take me. I did always know that I was going to have him mend whatever got broken.
And somewhat, you know, in terms of kind of the reparative or the healing, I would love to talk a little bit about the character of Lonnie, who I think is at once like the most hopeful, but also the most vulnerable of the characters in this novel. So he goes through a period where he's cutting himself, but he believes, and in his way of enacting it, it's a kind of spiritual practice that is building a kind of superhero power for him. And I think a lot of the desire there is to make his family whole again, to fix the things that he sees as coming untethered. But I was interested if you could just talk a little bit about Lonnie as a character and kind of what POV or what desire he brings into the novel.
Yeah, so Lonnie represents this idea of what, sort of on the edge of still having the magic of childhood, but sort of being a kind of free fall where he's falling away from innocence because of what happened to Orville and because he's getting older, and that's sort of what that time period's about. But I was really wanting for Lonnie to still believe in that child way where anything feels possible, and to show the heartbreak of that we all know, like to go from what it's like to be a kid and really like have that make-believe mind to like having to grow up, and that the sorrow of that, wanting to play out in Lonnie through what the family was going through, but to still have him believe, like fully believe, like only a kid could, like if he shows everybody that he can fly, then they'll believe more. And this big idea around like we all need to get through this by believing we can. So wanting to represent that belief, but also the inevitable heartbreak of sort of having to grow up. And in his case, like you said, he was the most vulnerable and ends up kind of reacting the strongest in a way to what the family does or does not do to help itself, you know, stay together.
Yeah, you know, I'm curious about his kind of move at the end. You know, one of the things that I had wondered and then corrected myself, because I was like, as I got towards the end, I was like, are there just moments of kind of joy. And then I was reminded that there are actually many moments of joy in this novel, like, and kind of moments where either a private joke is kind of shared. You know, there's a moment when I think Opal says, you know, let's pray about it. And then they smile because they're like, oh, I remember that's a thing that our grandmother used to say. And those moments of shared connection sometimes do feel a little bittersweet because you realize how tenuous the connection, you know, that they're sharing this private joke because only this other person would know this thing. And so like the tenuousness of that connection. But I'm wondering if kind of if so much of the book is about the past, the present, and the aftermath of what's happened to this family, I wonder if kind of Lonnie's, for lack of a better phrase, like the journey out is a kind of new future that's dawning, or a new possibility that's dawning at the end. You know, when he writes that letter, it does seem like he's heading towards healing, as also, as you said, is Orville too, you know, is kind of like getting himself together. So kind of how do you see the futures of these characters?
Yeah, so I was trying to write with as much hope as I could for this family through Orville and Lonnie. But I also didn't want to have it be unrealistic. And I also wanted to keep it open for several reasons. And without spoiling it, I don't know if that matters at this point. When I finished There, I felt very cynical. And even though I conceived the thing as a tragedy from the very beginning, at the end of 2016, we were seeing Standing Rock play out on TV, these horrific scenes, and Trump got into power. And very much the writing of the end of There was influenced by what was happening in the world and my worldview at the time. And with Wandering Stars, when I was finishing, I just felt like I really needed to believe that these people, these characters can heal and have a clear, at least indication to the reader that that is where they are headed. Insofar as they can express it as characters, and Lonnie, you know, he's not coming home and they're going to have a big party for him. He's like, I don't know if you guys are even going to be there, but I hope you're there. You know, it's this like sober hope. It's like this earned belief in that things could work out after having gone to these darker places where you don't believe in anything anymore. So really wanting to send the end of the book home in this way that makes the reader believe. And like I said, it's an earned belief after going through all of this stuff. So it's not an easy, you know, things are going to work out, but it's wanting to give the reader also resolve and to make it easy for the reader to believe that there's a reason to hope at the end of the book for what's going to happen to the family.
And as we kind of wrap up, I'm wondering if you could talk, you know, kind of maybe on the theme of futures, if you could talk a little bit about the work that you do as a teacher at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, but also your work with a lot of youth, including a story I literally read yesterday in the New York Times about you visiting students at the Millennium Art Academy in New York. Students who your book There was something that the students had connected so deeply with, and it's become a kind of recurring part of the curriculum. So can you talk a little bit about that work that you do as a teacher and transmitter, in addition to your more public work as an author?
I've been teaching at the Institute of American Indian Arts as a mentor, that's what we're called, since 2017. So even before There came out, the director of the school, when I was a student there, said, if you publish a book, I'll give you a teaching job. And that was essentially the goal, was to just get a teaching job and somehow publish anywhere that would take me. That was the early dream. There's a lot of teachers at the school that have been important and vital to the program. And I've taken like between 1 and 4 students at a time, not a heavy load, and it's remote work. So you're really responding to their manuscript, and basically their future books is what you're working on. Your thesis is supposed to be your eventual book. So I'm giving as honest feedback as I can to be helpful toward them, seeing what their book might be, or helping to develop their individual voices. But I guess I don't want to come off like I'm doing this. But there's a lot of teachers that work really hard and put in a lot of time, and that is their life. And I don't teach as much as most. So I don't want to sound like I'm doing more than I am through the school. I do try to give students whose work I believe in access to the publishing world, and I'll send their work to my agency. And, I do try to be an advocate and blurb any students that end up with a book coming out of the program. I try to blurb, but that's certainly not very much. And so the thing that came out in the New York Times was really sweet experience, really powerful experience. That is not something typically that's happened. There's been a handful of experiences where I've got to meet high schoolers who just love the book and have connected to reading for the first time through the book, which has been an amazing thing. So that experience in the Bronx was just powerful, the way that they connect to the characters in the book and what the characters have experienced. And there was only one Native student in that class, but it's for other reasons that they're connecting to the some of the harder aspects of the lives of these characters. And there's been a few Oakland high schools that I've gone to and had the same experience of some of these students deeply connecting to the work in super meaningful ways. So I'm not directly working with any high schools or programs, but I do try to, if I get invited, if somebody reaches out, I do try to show up for the kids, especially, when I first started doing the tour and going out as a public person, I was terrified of high school kids. I think early on, I was in Wisconsin and a teacher had been an early adapter, had done all this work to get there into the school right away. And it was one of the scariest readings I've ever done, was to go in front of the high school kids. But now I've done it enough over these 6 years that there's been out. Now it's my favorite thing, because to see kids loving reading for the first time through something that I wrote is amazing, because I wasn't a reader in high school and I wish somebody would have found the right book for me to give me access and to start my path sooner than I did, which was not until in my mid-20s.
Okay, so then my last question is that you published There back in 2018, which feels, I think it's pre-pandemic, it feels like a lifetime ago just because of the weird way that time works now. But since that year, there have been mainstream TV programs like Reservation Dogs, which is now entering its third season. Lily Gladstone has won a Golden Globe and gotten an Oscar nomination for her performance. And there's that recent Marvel series, Echo, which, as I was reading your book, I was like, oh, this in some ways is maybe the kind of indigenous superhero that Lonnie is dreaming about in Wandering Stars. And so I'm curious what you think this kind of increase in broader kind of mainstream representation of indigenous stories and experiences means. Are we at a moment of, kind of Native American storytelling renaissance, or do you see this as a kind of cyclical, or a word that I've kept using throughout our conversation, a kind of tenuous moment in which it could go either way?
So I think there's a lot of reason to believe that this moment is more significant than our other renaissances. And we've had multiple renaissances, which means that we've had multiple deaths of interest in Native stories and in storytelling. So there was one in the 90s after Dances with Wolves swept the Oscars. That actually open up a lot of doors for people, because people became curious about Native stories again at that time period. To some extent, what's happening right now began in that Standing Rock moment. There was another moment after the original occupation of Alcatraz and stuff going on around the civil rights movement and the Wounded Knee occupation. There are these moments that spark interest, and then there's some years of momentum that has been the pattern. I think this time around, it feels more significant, and it comes alongside other things like diversity in publishing and the George Floyd moment and the racial reckoning. There's other things that are making this moment feel like it could be sustainable and could grow. Whereas before, it was sort of like a swelling and then a dying out, because a lot of these structural things were not in place. Having a place like the Institute of American Indian Arts, having an institution that is consistently churning out authors, people that are writing books, it's a book-based program, who have access to teachers, who have access to the publishing world, means we have, at least this one institutional piece that, and books keep coming out of the program. So I think there are a lot of reasons to believe that this will keep going. And the fact that it's basically been since 2016 or 2017, 7 years is not nothing. It doesn't appear to be slowing. It appears to be still growing. And so all these things are signs of health. And I think I just hope that it keeps going the way it's going.
Thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Tommy Orange about his new novel, Wandering Stars. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the LARB Radio Hour. Subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please rate us on Apple Podcasts to help us get the word out. And we'd love to hear from you. The producers at the LARB Radio Hour are Medea Ocher, Kate Wolf, and Eric Newman. Our executive producer is Alan Minsky. Our sound engineer is Matea Baim. Editorial production by Jake Levins. Our intro music was written and performed by Imogen Teasley-Vaughton.